Welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast, where you'll learn how to structure terms and use various creative financing strategies to create profitable deals for short and long-term wealth. Whether you're a buy and hold investor, wholesaler, or flipper, learning creative financing will help you do more deals and unlock profits that you may not even know existed. On the Creative Financing Podcast, we break down actual deals we and our guests are doing and simplify the methods and terms used to execute these strategies. Now, let's dive in and create some terms.
Hello and welcome to the Creative Financing Podcast. This is Jonathan Gallegos. Guys, right here in this episode, we're literally just picking up where we left off with our interview with Jax Petty, attorney at law here in Utah. He's a whiz at creative financing. He's probably one of the top guys that utilizes contracts for deeds. I'm not gonna say much more here. We're just gonna jump right back into that conversation with our interview with Jax Petty. So this is part two. Thanks, guys, and enjoy.
That's correct.
Yeah. Did you have something that you wanted to add, Jonathan?
So if we could just back up just a little bit, because a lot of the people that are going to be listening to this podcast, this might be their first, second, third, or fourth time even being introduced to a contract for deed.
Start at the beginning.
Could you just give us like a brief description of contract for deed?
Certainly.
And then what I'd like to do is kind of get into some objections that other investors have for using contracts for deed.
Certainly. So sometimes when you talk to somebody about ownership and title, they consider those to be the same thing, and they're not. Even in a normal transaction, ownership transfers at the time valid consideration is given for the deed. The reason you record the deed is because statutorily that puts the world on notice that that ownership transfer has occurred. Now nobody else can come and say, well, I've got a deed too. You know, where I actually was the buyer of this property. And we can get into the fact that there are race states and notice states, and Utah is a race notice state, but that would just confuse the issue. So for now,
okay,
we're just going to say that you record to put the world on notice. And that's what the county is. It's a registry of deeds. But that still sounds foreign to people until they think about buying a car with a bank loan. You know, if they buy a car with a bank loan, it's their car. Just like if the buyer buys a home on a contract for deed, they own the home.
Mm-hmm.
But with both in the bank loan example, the title is held at the bank,
right,
until the contract of financing is paid off. In the contract for deed scenario, even though the buyer owns the property, the title is held by the seller. And it presents some interesting questions on occasion. For example, what if the seller gets a judgment? Well, that's been dealt with very succinctly, and if you study the case law, it's very, very clear. In Utah, the seller retains a personalty interest only, a right to receive payments, just like they do on the all-inclusive. They're in the exact same legal position. So if a seller gets a judgment and they've sold on an all-inclusive or a contract for deed, that does not legally attach to the property. It can attach to the seller's remaining interest. So let's say the seller still has $30,000 they're owed. Their judgment creditor could come in, or their bankruptcy trustee could come in, you know, and say in both instances, we're going to take that $30,000 when it's paid off. We're going to take any payments that seller might be receiving. But they can't preempt the buyer's ownership interest in that scenario. So you'll get the bankruptcy questions, you'll get the judgment questions, and it's similar also in what if the buyer gets a judgment. Now there are some bankruptcy attorneys that don't fully understand this, and so I won't bore people that are listening with the full understanding, but succinct to say, if you buy in an all-inclusive, you as the buyer could get a judgment. The foreclosure sale will terminate your interest with one glaring exception. That is the IRS. They have a right of redemption. Why? Because they said they did.
They're the IRS.
They are. So It doesn't mean that you, as in fact my father, had the seminal case before the Utah Supreme Court on this. And he had told his clients, they wanted to go in and fix the property up before the redemption period was up, and he said, anything you do is along the lines of repairs, if the IRS redeems, they'll reimburse you for. Anything you do as far as improvements, new carpet that's not moldy.
This was paint. The seller that had the IRS lien on the property.
Correct.
And then sold it to the investor.
Exactly.
Okay.
Anything you do as far as improvements will not be reimbursed, and that's exactly what happened. Second to the last day, the IRS redeemed, and the client wanted to get back the improvements, not just the repairs. So they got exactly what they were told they were going to get. They got reimbursed for doing things like repairing the roof, because that's a repair. They did not get anything as far as, you know, new cabinets.
So nothing for the upgrades.
I'm surprised they got reimbursed for the repairs.
Well, you will. You'll get reimbursed for the...
It,
for example, if the roof's leaking and it's causing further damage, it's in the IRS's best interest to have you fix that.
Sure.
And so they'll and it's not like really their choice, because that's what the court, Utah Supreme Court, decided is yes, they will reimburse you.
So that's interesting. So would it be patch the roof or replace the roof? So
it's what's necessary. Not what you want to do. So I'm guessing patch the roof.
Yes. Yet you want to replace the roof. So
well, you know, if the roof was about to cave in,
right?
Not really. Patching is going to be more expensive than replacing. I think you'd have a very good argument. I don't like making arguments to the IRS. I like to stay in the this is what was decided realm.
Yeah.
So I just say if it's necessary. You want as much evidence that it was necessary as possible if you're doing the repairs prior to the expiration of the redemption period. So that's how it works with a foreclosure or an all-inclusive or if you buy the property a foreclosure sale, and that's the only remainder interest that could exist after the foreclosure sale is that IRS redemption interest. With a contract for deed, there is actually in the IRS code, a notice period you have to go through, or a notice process you have to go through to extinguish IRS liens. And so if you give the proper notice, interestingly enough, at the end of that 30-day forfeiture, if you gave the correct notice, the IRS's interest terminates.
And so that means that if the seller, so if I'm selling you my property on contract for deed, mm-hmm. and then I get an IRS lien.
Well, yours wouldn't attach. Remember, you just have a personality interest.
So it's the same as a judgment, as that if I've already sold the property on contract for deed,
right?
IRS wouldn't attach the house because I'm no longer the owner.
Correct. So we're talking about the buyer gets an IRS
lien. I got it.
Or the buyer gets a judgment.
Okay.
So if the buyer gets a judgment, we went through just now the IRS process, but if the buyer gets a judgment, you'd, at the completion of the forfeiture process, request the court to certify the forfeiture.
So, let me back up real quick, just so I can make this clear, mm-hmm. is that, so the buyer now has a judgment or an IRS lien against them.
Correct.
And they are defaulting on their contract for deed.
Correct.
Okay.
So the seller is doing the 30-day forfeiture process.
Okay.
And for those that don't know, the reason I like to sell on a contract for deed versus an all-inclusive is because my risk is roughly 400% more time-wise with an all-inclusive. I have a four-month foreclosure instead of a 30-day or one-month forfeiture like I would on a contract for deed. So again, if there are judgments or other issues, you can actually have the court certify the forfeiture, which takes about 2 weeks, significantly less expensive than a foreclosure, even with certifying it. So it's, for most sellers, and Jeff, I think you found this, most sellers are more apt to do a sale on seller financing if they don't have to relinquish that title, even though
sure.
they're giving up the same ownership.
Yep. I would totally agree with that. So if what ends up happening to the IRS lien or judgment in the forfeiture process? What would happen?
So just like the foreclosure, if they're given the correct notice, their interest does not attach to the property once the buyer's interest has been terminated.
And if it was not in default, then it would attach, and when they go to sell the house, refinance the property, the judgment holder or the IRS are to be paid off out of any kind of proceeds.
Just like if they got a bank loan or all-inclusive or a contract for deed, buyer judgments, if the buyer still owns the property, would need to be paid at the point of refinance or sale.
So seller is protected even though the buyer may have, you know, judgments, liens, whatever. Mechanics lien work the same way as far as if the buyer did some work to the property, had some work done to the property and didn't pay?
So that, maybe that's a whole other hour discussion right there. But let me just tell you something interesting.
Okay.
In order for a mechanics lien to be perfected, the person doing the work has to have a contract with, and I believe the phrasing is, the title holder, right?
No.
So
that's a bit of an issue.
Theoretically, there's no way. I mean, you can always come up with scenarios. Generally, I think you could argue that it would be very difficult to perfect a mechanics lien on a contract for deed sale, because the owner of the property, you can't file it against them because they're not the ones on title to sign your contract, and the previous owner isn't going to sign it because they don't own it anymore. So it, not that I'm saying it would be a complete bar. I think there are some judges on the bench that would just say, you're right, Mr. Attorney, but I don't care.
Yeah.
But I do think...
You would have an argument.
You'd have a very good argument, and it would take a skilled attorney, and usually mechanics liens are not highly litigated as far as three-day court proceedings, but who knows.
Okay. So just to clarify, because there's so many different types, I mean, they're all kind of the same. Land contract, agreement for bond for...
Bond for deed, yes.
They're all very similar, if not almost exactly the same. However, the forfeiture process that you're talking about in Utah may not actually be in, you know, various other parts of the country. Is that correct?
Right. As I mentioned earlier, there are states that have codified their process. So in Washington, for example, they have a codified process you have to go through that's different than the common law forfeiture process. And so certainly,
still better than the forfeiture or the foreclosure process?
I've never done a foreclosure in Washington, nor have I done a forfeiture in Washington. So I won't speculate on that because I don't have actual experience. But I do think it is critical to state this discussion is about investing in Utah and Utah law, which I'm licensed to discuss.
Sure.
Other states, which I've done contract for deed work in numerous other states, but we always have a local attorney review the documentation as per that state's law.
And which is a great idea for anyone doing really any kind of seller financing all across the country, is, you know, whether it's a title company that is totally familiar with the laws and, you know, hopefully just like what we have here, a title company that the owner's an attorney, which would be ideal. But if not, then, you know, at least dealing with an attorney to make sure you know what the rules and laws are before you just...
Yes, always check with your local attorney.
Yeah, before you just start thinking that... I heard this on a podcast, and it should work wherever I am.
Well, it'll work, but it may have a different remedy at the end.
I agree. I'm wondering, Jax, you know, do you ever see, and this was always a concern of mine, that if you sell on a contract for deed, and I don't know that there's really any difference, it wouldn't really matter, but someone starts doing a bunch of work to your house. So, and when I say work, let's say they gut it and they have these grand ideas, or, you know, they don't pull permits, they don't finish.
People do that?
Yeah, it happens. How do you protect yourself, whether it's contract for deed or not, really? How do you protect yourself to you know, make sure that, that you don't end up with a shell of a house when you had something a little different, or you know, you're red tagged and under investigation from the city because no permits were pulled.
So that is a great question, and there's two answers I want to give. One is, I don't know if you saw in the news recently, but a gentleman flew a plane into his own house.
Right? I did, yes.
There's not much we can do in the documents to solve for crazy.
Yeah.
But there is generally always a clause you can put in to protect yourself. So when an investor asks me that question, I'll recommend one of the clauses that indicates that they have rights of inspection, that any, and then usually we'll see any structural changes require the written permission of the seller. Any work has to be done by licensed individuals. Permits have to be pulled for any work to be done on the property. But you want that right of inspection as one of those clauses, because obviously if they're doing something in the basement, strangely enough, I've never run into that in 24 years on a contract for deed, but I did have an investor that had an all-inclusive they sold on a very nice home in Bluffdale, and the buyer unfortunately was one of those males that they can do anything because by darn they were good at Legos as a kid.
Yep.
And gutted the basement and then lost his job. And
yep.
So I think that...
That never happens, by the way.
No.
Never.
But I think having those clauses in there and having a frank discussion with the people up front is a very good thing. And here's a little trick I use that has nothing to do with legal expertise. When I sell to a seller finance buyer, I go and look at where they live now, because you can usually tell what's going to go on in your property.
Sure.
By what's going on there. But I think the flip side is also true. I've seen on two different contracts for deed sales where the buyers put in over $100,000 in improvements. One of those, the seller got back.
Yeah.
So I've never seen $100,000 in improvements on a lease option. Could happen.
Mm-hmm.
I wouldn't expect it.
No.
At least not a non-commercial, I would say. But when people own the home, and again, I think lease options definitely have their place. I teach on lease options as part of my course that I teach to agents,
yep,
to realtors. But I think there is, and you ask anyone off the street even, is there a difference between when it comes to a home, an owner's mentality versus a renter's mentality? Nobody's got the answer wrong yet. You know, they all realize that that difference exists. And so when people feel like they own it, like it's their home, even though your remedy is almost the same time-wise as just leasing the property out, you see a significant difference in the ownership and quality of care.
Yep.
Yeah, pride of ownership factor there.
Mm-hmm. I totally agree.
So remedies for death,
mm-hmm,
that's kind of an objection that I've heard other investors
death for whom
talk about. So
dying is generally bad.
So
for everyone involved.
So death of the seller.
Okay.
What happens in that scenario?
So that is a very good question. So that what people don't understand is there's no separate category for contract for deed versus everything else, right? If you do a bank loan, if you do an all-inclusive contract for deed, it's pretty much going to be the same thing. The contract inures to the benefit of the heirs, and so they have the same responsibilities and the same benefits as the decedent, the person that passed away. So in a contract for deed scenario, if the seller passed away, we actually add some additional protections. So typically there will be an escrow company involved in the transaction, and the escrow company will hold two documents. One of the things you want to do when you close a contract for deed is record a notice of that contract for two reasons. One, to protect the buyers, but two, if the buyers go to refinance, the lender will require that as a way of refinancing the property. And it's counterintuitive, but you can refinance these as a buyer even though you're not on title. You can refinance them under FHA guidelines, conventional guidelines, VA. I mean, it's...
That's amazing.
If somebody knows how to do it, it's actually an easy thing to do.
But you have to have a notice of contract filed on title.
Right. But because you're giving that interest, the escrow company should hold a release of notice that once the forfeiture is completed, so the forfeiture eliminates the contractual ownership interest, that release of the notice can be recorded. And the other thing we do is we have a deed from the sellers in the event the sellers were to disappear, because all they have is that remainder interest, and their obligation is when they're getting paid off to pass that final title piece as well.
Right.
And so we've, you know, thankfully we don't have people pass away or disappear that often, but that's, those remedies have been upheld. And so you protect, and sorry, I didn't mean to cut you off, but I think it's important to state in all of these, it has to protect and make sense for both sides.
Right.
If you write the most incredible contract for you and the world, and that seller goes into court and the judge thinks that you are not a favorable individual, trial court judges don't have to write their opinions. They just get to say, I rule for this other party, and you get to pay your 40 grand to do an appeal, right? You might, the law might be on your side, the facts might be on your side, the contract might be on your side, but I would caution you against not showing in your negotiation that there's some benefit to the other party, because it can come back to bite you. Sorry, go ahead.
So I was just going to ask, do you have the seller sign a warranty deed up front or a quick claim deed up front?
You haven't signed a deed as part of the closing, yes. And so it's, typically you'd use a deed that would pass the remainder interest the seller has, but the ownership's already been passed. So it's just the title piece that gets passed if that were the case.
Gotcha.
So if the seller was to die, would it end up in probate? Or in a state, as far as that interest in that property, if there's still an equitable proceeds coming to that seller, whether it's monthly or, you know, down the road somewhere.
So because, Jeff, if it's done correctly, like our office does it, if you've solved for the title transfer piece of the pie, that question, it's simply getting the payoff from the escrow company. And there are a couple of different escrow agents, escrow companies we see use. One is Elite Contract Servicing, one is Escrow Specialist. Both of them understand these. Both of them are very efficient at doing their part in it. But as the title company for the buyer, we just get the payoff, send in the payoff. We're protected by statute, Utah statute, saying that they have to reconvey. There's a statutory reconveyance process, if it's an all-inclusive, that you can do to eliminate the remaining deed. If it's a contract for deed, you send the payoff and the deed's been released as part of the escrow instructions to the escrow company. It's not as complex as some people that have never done one would like to imagine. They create these Rube Goldberg scenarios that just in reality don't exist. And that's okay. They don't know any better. But they also shouldn't prognosticate on something they don't do day in and day out.
So if the seller was to die, the proceeds could still go to the seller's heirs.
Yes. So typically, I mean, the way the money transfers through, it's sent to the escrow company. That pays off the contract. First amount we're going to send is to the underlying mortgages to pay those off. The remainder goes to the escrow company. And the escrow company deposits that into the same account they've been depositing the monthly payments. So okay. It's a, from the buyer's side, it's almost transparent. They
to them. So the seller would then, or the seller's heirs would then have to work to get access to that account through.
Right. Well, they'd usually have a POD on the account, so a payable on death. But. That's not really the buyer's concern at that point.
As far as if the buyer passed away.
So their heirs could complete the contract.
Okay.
But if the buyer passes away and payments aren't made, you just forfeit out the buyer's interest just like you would any other way.
Yep. Did you want to ask?
That's pretty easy in that scenario. If the buyer dies.
Yeah.
Okay. So, how about divorce on the seller side? What happens in that scenario if two people are on title when they did a contract for deed on the seller side?
So that one we've seen more often. And that is, again, it doesn't provide any complications because the divorce is only going to decide how the distribution of proceeds is going to be done. So typically, is the title company, again, doing the refinance or the sale for the contract for deed buyer, we don't get into that too much because they don't own the property. And typically, again, we would just be sending it to the escrow company that in the initial contract, it was agreed to by the parties, they would keep track of the payments, they would provide the payoff. And so typically those proceeds would be divided by the escrow company based on a court order or an agreement between the parties. But more often than not, it's still just sent to the account they were sending the monthly payments to. And then based on the agreement, part of that would be transferred to one of the other parties. So the divorce is not an issue in an all-inclusive or a contract for deed sale because the ownership has already passed.
Right. Okay. That was pretty easy.
What about on the buyer side? Does it matter? I mean, one of them decides who gets the house and...
No. So on the buyer side, you do see divorces because a lot of times they'll be buying seller finance because they weren't wizards with their money to begin
sure.
with. And it doesn't affect the seller. The buyers either complete the contract or they don't. But typically you'd just see a sale of the property at that point, or you'd see one of the two parties refinance the property and pay the other ones out, whatever equity might be mandated by the court. So.
Yep, so easy.
Yeah.
Was there another one or last one?
Easy. So bankruptcy, on the seller side, mm-hmm. does it matter if they've sold the property on contract for deed? Can a bankruptcy trustee come in?
So short answer, no. But let's take it to a general sale scenario. So if somebody comes to you and they say, I'll sell you my house for a dollar, and they sell you their house for a dollar, and the next day they file bankruptcy, Steve Rupp, the trustee, is going to undo that sale. I'm just telling you. It doesn't matter what else happens, right? So it just has to do with if the seller files bankruptcy on a normal sale transaction, the trustee was going to look at how much time has passed since the sale and the bankruptcy was filed, and was there basically was it done to defraud the creditors? Okay, and so you get sellers that are like so upset with the people they owe money to, they'll sell it for 180 when it's worth 320.
Mm-hmm.
Now, if you are honestly didn't know any of this, you're a bona fide third party buyer, there are some laws that protect you. But if you knew, hey, you've got emails going back and forth where he's like, I'm just gonna sell it to you for 180. Because, I don't want to use some inappropriate language. That's a great way to say it. Stiff my other creditors, that may not be the great deal you think it is. Mm-hmm. And again, it has nothing to do with whether it's seller financing or not. It just has to do with if something was done to defraud the creditors, the bankruptcy trustee can undo that sale. So it would work the same in whatever scenario on the sale with that as a general rule.
Gotcha. Gotcha. That's a great answer. Thank you.
What about on the buyer's side, a bankruptcy from the buyer?
So a bankruptcy from the buyer, typically in all, in bank notes, all-inclusive notes, or a contract for deed, insolvency or bankruptcy is going to qualify as a default.
Okay.
It doesn't mean if the seller is getting their payments, they have to do the forfeiture process, but typically it'll qualify as a default on behalf of the buyer. The trustee, again, is now in control of that buyer's financial estate and will generally put a priority on a place to live as far as payments if it's a 13. If it's a 7, it's going to depend on how much equity is in the property, just like it would any creditor scenario when it comes to real property. So I haven't seen complications with bankruptcy of a buyer. The only one I've been involved in where they were trying to do a seller financing transaction and bankruptcy presented an issue was, and actually it wasn't, the bankruptcy didn't work because they'd committed federal tax fraud to a very large amount, and they were trying to sell $1 million property to their daughter for $50,000. And for some reason, that just didn't pass the smell test with the IRS or the bankruptcy trustee. So
some people are so smart.
Yes. So, yeah, I mean, I think, again, there's not some separate category for seller finance in all of these. It's going to be the same general rules that are going to apply with the IRS, with the bankruptcy courts. But make sure your deals pass the smell test would probably be the bottom line takeaway from that part of the discussion.
Okay.
So what's the biggest concern or objection you typically hear, or, you know, other investors come up with when it comes to contract for deed?
Oh, same as most things, you know, just lack of education. And I tell people, I may not give you the answer you want, but at least you'll get the correct answer. And as, you know, as Jeff's question earlier, if I don't know the answer, I'm not going to guess. But there are a lot of people that do guess. And so 99% of the objections are, well, I heard from, you know, my hairdresser or something. but I think when people understand it, they understand, hey, this is another tool in my tool chest. Mm-hmm. This is another thing that I can use. And knowledge really is power when it comes to real estate investing.
Right.
You know, and one thing that I find fascinating at the moment is when you start understanding, and this is completely another day, but when you start understanding the new tax law and the what I call super depreciation you can do on a property you bought on seller financing, you can, let's use my example, if I'm into it for $10,000, I might be able to depreciate $75,000 and take that off my taxes.
Wow.
So there's some really cool things you can do right now that will, especially if you're doing it in the new zones they've got for economic improvement, which are not done because they're low income. If you look at the maps, it's purely political, but that's great for investors too, I think.
Sure.
Right.
Anyway, if you have no idea what I'm talking about, go research it a little bit, because if you're investing and don't understand that, you're missing out on some significant assistance from the federal government to help you not pay taxes. Shockingly, yep. Trump, of all people, helped out real estate investors. Oh, wait, that is how he made his money.
I love it.
So just a couple last questions and we'll wrap this thing up. So this is back, and I know the answer to this, but I want everyone to hear this. Should an investor write up their own, whether it's contract for deed or trust deed and note, or all-inclusive trust deed and note, docs themselves?
You know, I have a lot of clients now because they did that and found out the hard way, what I call life's tuition.
Yep.
That was a bad idea.
The school of hard knocks.
Right. So even if, let's just pretend, even if that person wrote the perfect contract, now there's litigation from the other side. So who wrote up this contract? You never want to say, I did, to the judge. You want to say, you know, a real estate attorney that was a neutral party wrote up this contract. Yep. If not, sooner or later you may be paying some significant life's tuition.
Yep.
And the attorney's fees in those alone are usually pretty substantial. And what you find out is, wait a minute, doesn't the judge know I'm telling the truth and I'm a good guy? No, he doesn't, or she doesn't. So you're the big bad investor trying to take advantage of this poor, helpless, not professional real estate investor. And I get this feeling, and we have one of the best judiciaries, I think, but Utah's laws are very pro-business. So sometimes it feels like the judges try to help the people out instead of the business. And if you've been in court and found that to be the case, I have a builder that he's learned that lesson the hard way a few times.
Yep.
He's the big rich builder, and even though he's right, he loses.
Yep.
You know? So I would never tell anyone you're not good enough, smart enough, and doggone it, people don't like you enough to write your own contracts. Mm-hmm. But I do think it's a mistake.
And I would totally agree with you. And actually, a lot of the title companies, unless there's an attorney that works in-house, they won't write up the docs.
Well, but legally, they can't. The contract for deed is not a fill-in-the-blank document. It has to be prepared by an attorney. And we charge the same for one of those closings about as a normal closing.
Right. You know?
But if I've done them just as an attorney, where they don't want me to participate in the closing,
yeah,
and $3,200, they're fine with that. Yeah. You know?
But, well, and you've done some docs for me for out of state. So,
but it's
necessary.
It is, but it's, like you said, it's much more efficient and less expensive if you combine the attorney with the title company and the knowledge on how to do
it. Yeah. So when you're looking for a title company and you're looking at doing creative financing, you know, that's something that you want to ask up front, because last thing you want is go create a deal, take it to your title company, and they're like, we're not doing that for you.
Yeah. So, Jeff, what company would you use?
So do you want a plug? Is that what I'm hearing?
No, I just was curious.
Well, if I'm doing contract for deed, there is literally no one that I would use other than First Liberty Title. So, but it's more than First Liberty. It's you. It's really having that attorney that, hey, if there's a legal question, I mean, I don't know how much normally this little meeting, you know, conversation would cost. You are an attorney. I know you're not cheap, so this would be several hundreds of dollars. And to be able to come into your office and say, Jax, I have a question about this. How do I deal with this? I mean, that's a consultation normally. But now I have an attorney that can help me with my closing so that, hey, I can get this done and done properly.
I agree.
Yeah. So it's something to look for. And if you're in Utah, that's and you're doing any kind of creative financing or not, you should be checking out First Liberty Title and Jax Petty. So,
that was shocking and surprising you'd say that. Thank you, though.
Oh, you're welcome.
No idea.
So, Jax, what would you advise people on when it comes to looking for someone like yourself in other states? So, Jeff, you had this problem in Idaho.
Still do.
Can't find anyone, a title company in Idaho that will do a contract for deed. What would you suggest to those individuals who want to utilize this strategy but can't find
the
person to do it?
If you're back east, it's not going to be an issue.
Okay.
If you're on the West Coast.
And South, by the way, is probably not an issue either. So
right.
It might be a land contract, but it's basically the same.
Correct.
Yeah.
But if you're in a place where it's not something that everybody knows, I would start by finding an attorney-owned title company. But instead of going in and just asking them, do you do contract for deed work, I would say, you know, and if you want to email me, even if I'm never going to get a deal out of it, I'll send you the guidelines so that they can see it's, you know, something that's recognized nationally, the lenders recognize it. Because most attorneys are cautious by training. But if they understand that it's not something that's going to cause issues, and I'm fairly risk averse, but if I know something is valid, I'm going to try much harder to figure out how to do it than if I have questions on whether it's really valid or not.
Mm-hmm.
So I think I would go in with a little more than just a question. I'd go in with, you know, these are being done in other states. Here are the lender guidelines for refinancing them. This is something that you could significantly add to your business, and start the conversation that way. The problem comes when people don't know, and that's all of real estate. When they don't know, there's fear. When they understand it, there's not.
Okay.
Very, very true.
Yeah.
So, last question or two, and not really questions, but so you have a vast knowledge of market cycles. I've seen your presentations, your PowerPoint. If you were going to give some advice, if someone wanted to like start researching markets,
mm-hmm.
can you give any advice about where they should go to look for information that would be helpful?
So there's this new thing called Google that's pretty cool.
Google's pretty good. Okay.
But I think knowing what you're looking for is critical.
Yeah.
Things like availability of housing index, things like the availability of credit index. There are indexes that will show you plus or minus how affordable housing is. So let me give you an example. My brother, before the crash in 2007, called me from San Diego. He was working for the fifth biggest law firm in the world, making great money. Hated his life, but that's a different discussion. And he said, I would like to buy a property. I called Dad, but Dad referred me to you. What do you think? I said, give me a minute. The pricing in his area was 312% above what the average wage was.
Yep.
I said, Sean, as you always will, you'll do exactly what you decide to do. If it was me, there is no way on this green earth that I would buy a property right now. And he always wants to argue points, even if you just said what he's thinking.
Two attorneys going, having a conversation, want to
argue. He said, but. I said, I get the but, Sean. I know values have gone up and they're continuing to go up. You asked for my advice, short and simple. Here's the why. Here's the advice. Now, the house he was going to buy went down over $250,000 in value when he decided to move back and work for Huntsman. Did I ever get thanked for that? No. But I think...
He didn't have to move in with you, so that's probably thanks
enough. That is thanks enough. No, that's true. I think, and I actually was at an investor conference this afternoon and was asked some questions, and I said, look, the really intelligent investors I know are liquidating a lot of real estate right now. Not all. They're holding on to some that's, you know, like I don't want to sell the storage units.
Yep.
But single family residences, you're at the buy high phase in the cycle.
Yep.
There will be another, you know, buy low cycle. But this is the sell high.
Yep.
And so I think there are some things you can do. The investors I know that are really sophisticated, they're setting up credit facilities. The ones that I've set up, I've made sure they take out the parts that have to do with economic changes. It's funny because in 2005, 2006, I had banks throwing signature credit lines for $500,000 at me.
Yep.
And, you know, had I used all of those, the way the documents were structured, I would have been in trouble because they would have said, we want our money back now. Yep. Not that my circumstance had changed, not that the real estate I was working on had changed, but the banks got nervous.
Yep.
And so setting up credit facilities that you're going to have access to in the downturn that can't be terminated just because the bank feels like it, I think that's a good thing. But if I was to go and start buying single family homes to rent out, I think it would be a mistake at the moment. Yes, Utah has the youngest population in the nation, and not by a little bit. Yes, people that grow up here want to buy houses here and live here. Yes, we have a huge influx because of the dominant religion of people from around the world moving in. Yes to all of those things. But was that not the case in 2008?
Well, and in a lot of other areas as well across the country that are thriving. I mean, there are, Utah is not the only market that people are moving to that, is growing. We're not the only one. So it's an issue, maybe not every market across the country, but quite a few. Interesting. I know you used to teach some classes. I know that you teach realtors, but do you still teach investors? Are you still doing that?
I do. And Jeff, it's a difficult question in my mind because I love doing that, but also my kids are at that stage where, you know, I blink and all of a sudden they're at another milestone.
Sure.
And, you know, the two oldest play basketball for Alton, so during that season there's always the games, and it may be a little counterproductive as far as bottom line to not be teaching as many of those classes right now.
Sure.
But I will be doing some more. And so I'll let you know when I do those. But I feel like I'll have the whole rest of my life to find things to do in the evenings.
Yes, absolutely.
And so I'm maybe not being as aggressive as I was when they were little. So, but yes, short answer, yes.
And I've been a part of those. They're very informative. And so if you have interest, you can contact us here. And I will find out from Jax when the next class will be.
Have you ever been interested in canning and cloning those and selling a course online?
I have. And I've actually had a group pursue me to do the books and the tour and different things. And, you know, it's funny. The gentleman that wrote, that wanted to do the ebook and the hardbound and to do the tours, he's like, we've already pretty much got the book. You just need to change it. Because if you just take from one source, that's bad. But if you take from everyone, then you're okay. And I'm like, well, you know, I've kind of got my own book, if you will. But no, I've thought about it. I've considered it. I'll do it. Just not
when the timing
the top
is right.
Priority.
Yeah.
Right.
Cool.
It's awesome.
If you ever need help with that, let me know.
I will.
So we appreciate having you, Jax.
Absolutely.
Extremely informative, as I knew it would be.
I'm going to have to go back and listen to this because a lot of what you said was over my head. And so I'm still a student to this. And kind of part of the premise of this podcast is me learning from Jeff. And to get you on is very gratifying.
Yeah, and you're our first guest, by the way.
Yeah.
So I do appreciate it.
So
this was a friend thing that, you know, I called in, so I owe you one. We'll go to lunch or something on me.
That'd be great.
Jax, how do people get a hold of you if they live here in Utah and they want to use you?
So email address is jax@firstlibertytitle.com, and it's the number one followed by ST for first. So jax@1stlibertytitle.com. And the office number is 801-999-4028.
Great. One last question. Is there a question that we did not ask you that we should have?
Besides the all-important how much wood would a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood question? No. I think the questions were very well thought out.
Cool. Well, thanks so much.
You bet.
We do appreciate it. Thanks, yeah. Jax.
Thanks, guys, for listening. I think we're going to cut this into two parts. Guys, go to our website, www.thecreativefinancingpodcast.com. Find us there. Please give us some love, some five-star reviews on whatever platform you use for your podcasting. Also, we do have a hotline that we've been trying to get people to call in on.
I think we're going to change that. We'll talk about that in a
second. I think we're just going to see if someone would shoot us an email versus calling in. But if you guys have any interest in that, calling our hotline, asking a question or giving us a scenario and asking us how would we handle that, our phone number is 877-409-8090. Again, 877-409-8090. Any last words?
Nope, it's been great. I actually learned quite a bit today, and we're going to bring some more guests. We'll do some more interactive stuff. I'm really looking forward to it.
Cool. Thanks, guys. We're out.
Thanks for listening to the Creative Financing Podcast. We need your feedback to continue to bring you the best strategies in creative financing. So please subscribe, rate, and review the show on iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. We greatly appreciate your ear, and please pass this on. Until next time, create some terms. This show offers general information on creative financing strategies and real estate investments. Nothing contained herein should be considered personal, legal, or financial advice. Every state has individual laws governing the use and type of documents used to execute strategies discussed herein. You should consult with a local licensed real estate broker and attorney before relying on any information contained herein. Information is not guaranteed, and opinions of the guests are their own. Profits are not guaranteed, and there's always inherent risk in real estate investing.